Welcome to Career Tools. Today's topic, moving with your job, relocation packages, part two. Here we go.
Okay, talk about negotiation though. This is interesting. In my experience, far too many people, first of all, you know me, I don't even like the word negotiation. I used to teach the Harvard Negotiation Project, and the reason I don't like it is because people apply it to all kinds of situations where it literally isn't inapplicable. The example I have is the young person coming out of college says, "Can I negotiate my pay package?" And the company, if the company were smart, the company would say, "How can we negotiate? We'll be happy to give you more. What more can you give us? Have you been holding some little bit of energy in reserve? Are we not aware of some skill you have? You've been waiting until the negotiation phase?" A negotiation is a quid pro quo. So it's really not a negotiation in the pure sense of I'm going to give you more, you're going to give me more. But you are saying the package may have some flexibility.
Yeah, perhaps that's a better way to put it than negotiation.
So how much more money can I get?
No. No.
I thought you just said that it was unlikely flexible.
I think the reason people miss this is that they think this is an opportunity to get more out of the company. Whereas right. The company thinks that they're offering you something wonderful. They already think that you've got the good side of
this
the deal.
This is literally ambrosia and nectar of the gods. Yeah. And so the idea that you would negotiate for more is literally preposterous.
Exactly. Yes. It's like, I've just given you everything. How dare you ask for more?
There are a thousand people who would kill you for this opportunity, and you're sitting here saying, well, maybe I will, maybe I won't, because you're suddenly the gambler.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are exceptions to that. You know, if you're being sent to Siberia, it's possible that you might get more out of the company than if you're being sent to Paris, France, for example.
I wonder what people in Siberia consider Siberia and the rest of the world.
I don't know.
I wonder if it's Texas. I don't know.
I lived in Germany, I learned that every country has somewhere they tell jokes about.
Yeah?
Yeah, the English tell jokes about the Irish, and the Germans tell jokes about the Ostfriesians, I think.
Yeah?
Every country has somewhere.
You just made a joke about Alaska.
I did. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So a lot of the time when people think, oh, they see the relocation package and they think, oh, now I can negotiate for some more cash and think that I can make
or
out like a
richer
bandit.
Package in some
exactly.
fashion.
Exactly. And that's unlikely to happen because the company knows what cash it has and what it's already offered you. And
if they're internal people, they've got budgets. And,
exactly.
and if they give you cash, they're taking it from somebody in the future. Okay. All right. So then how do we negotiate?
On the other hand, if you want an extra week before you start the new job in the foreign country because you want to take your kids to school every day, or if you want if a container that's containing your goods will take 6 weeks if you share one, and only 4 weeks if you have a container of yourself, but that costs an extra $2,000, you might be able to negotiate that because you'll be moved into your house more quickly, your spouse will be happy, and you'll be back to work at peak efficiency more quickly. So it's a case of finding things where you have a good reason for wanting that extra.
The time.
Yeah,
right?
Time and benefits. And where it's also of a benefit to the company,
right.
Where you can demonstrate that you'll be effective more quickly. Those things you're more likely to get than if you just say, well, I need an extra $5,000.
Yeah, so as a general rule, if you're thinking more cash, wipe that out of your mind.
Yeah.
It's not that it never happens, but if that's what you think your leverage is, you're wrong. On the other hand, asking for more time or making somehow the move easier on your family, that's a discussion that companies are willing to have.
In my experience.
Okay, good. Yeah. But we gave a list, but the fact is every company is different.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger the company, the more profitable the company is, the longer the list is, and the more generous each of the benefits are on the list. The smaller the company, the shorter the list, and at some point, small companies have nothing. I assume there's got to be something about you got to know the policy.
Oh, yeah. And usually that's the first thing that happens. You know, somebody says, would you like to do this job in Paris, France? And you say, I'd love a job in Paris, France. And can you tell me some more about it? And somebody hands you something that's an inch thick.
So when you say, okay, you and I both know this. We teach kids in college. Sorry, folks, but we'll call them kids for now. We teach young adults in college that when somebody says, how would you feel about a job in X? The first thought is, I'd love a job in X. And the kids push back and say, well, am I accepting the offer by saying I'd love a job in Paris?
No.
By the way, folks, Wendy's new to podcasting, so she just shook her head furiously left to right. But basically, yeah, but people are afraid, right? You and I both know this. I'd love a job in Paris. Well, am I accepting? No, you're not accepting. You're simply saying you're expressing interest in a job in Paris. You're reciprocating the desire the company has expressed towards you. And now the discussion begins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Like, why would you turn down a job in Paris? Well, you don't know until you know what the details
exactly. are. Exactly. So you say, I'd love a job in Paris. Help me understand more.
Exactly.
Can you explain the details?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And often that'll be, well, if it's your manager who's offered you this job in Paris, it'll be, that HR person will be down with a package or the policy or whatever to come talk you through it. Because managers tend not to know the details.
Okay. Put you on the spot here. Not in the show notes. Manager says, let me tell you about the package. HR person says, let me tell you about the package. What percentage of managers or professionals actually has a pen in their hand and starts writing things down? What does your gut tell you?
Zero.
Yeah, I was going to say 20.
Because they're still thinking, I'm going to Paris.
Or what's the job? Who's going to be my boss, right?
Yeah.
And then they've got somebody saying, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, for this. And then what happens is they go home and they tell their spouse, by the way, we got offered Paris. And it's always we, by the way, which is kind of weird. But anyway, it's like my daughter's mom saying, we're having chemotherapy. I remember thinking, no, really, we're not. She is. But you go home and the spouse immediately says, well, what's the deal? Well, how is it going to work? And you say, oh, I got a call, but I don't really know anything. And that moment right there, there's already a slight rift between those two spouses, because the spouse, and in this case, what we would call the trailing spouse, no offense, male, female, irrelevant, the person who takes the move, the other spouse is the trailing spouse. The trailing spouse's experience in the transition is not counterbalanced by the joy of the promotion or the new job or the increased visibility or the expat nomenclature. And so they get, you know, all of the pain and none of the joy, so to speak, after fashion. And so if you're listening to what is being included in the package and you don't take notes, and then you go to your spouse and they say, what's the package? And you say, I don't know. I'm really just thinking about the job.
Yeah.
You're already starting off on the wrong foot.
Yeah. That's the wrong way to go.
Smaller companies.
So smaller companies might not have a policy. They might borrow a policy from somebody else, but they might not have a policy. It could be that you're the first person to move.
Right.
And in those situations, it's more likely that you'll be negotiating on a case-by-case basis with your boss. So your boss says, we want you to open an office in, I don't know, where shall we go? Seattle,
yeah.
And you say, great. Okay, and your boss says, well, go work it out.
Yeah, work it out, yeah.
And
be careful, be safe, but work it out.
Yeah. And you can start with the list that we gave you at the beginning of the podcast as a list of possible things that you're going to need to consider.
Let's give them a quick key. Forget the city that they're in. Let's say they're in Birmingham, Alabama. What would be the first thing you would tell them? Assume that the company has a new office in Seattle. Let's assume that it's an opportunity for them. And so from a career perspective, if there wasn't a move, you'd absolutely take this career opportunity. What would be the first thing you'd suggest they look at, Birmingham to Seattle?
Cost of living?
Yeah. Boom. Exactly the same thing. I'd want to know, is it 88 in Birmingham and 102 in Seattle?
Yeah.
Is it 81? Is it 98? Is it 105? Is it because you know what your boss is thinking? Well, you're getting 80 now. This is a big opportunity. The opportunity is what you ought to be going for, not the salary increase.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I agree with the boss. If Seattle is a new office and you're opening up the office, by all means, pay me the same amount. But the question is, am I getting the same amount of cash or am I keeping the same standard of living? But and the answer, therefore, and in the boss's mind, if he or she hasn't thought it through, they're thinking it should be the same. Not because they're trying to cut back on your cost of, on your standard of living. By no means are they trying to do that. They're just not thinking about the cost of living index. No. That's the place you start. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Okay.
So that's kind of, well, particularly in small companies and it's just you and your boss, that is a conversation that will end up being ongoing because you don't know the data. And he probably hasn't even thought of it at the beginning, and then you're going to have a kind of ongoing conversation about...
Yeah, okay, but what do I think about ongoing conversations? What do most directs tend to do when it comes to ongoing conversations?
Under-communicate.
Yeah, I was going to say under-report. They just, right? So if I'm the boss and I'm asking you to go to Shanghai or Seattle or whatever, and you're the direct having to make the decisions, you've got to over-communicate.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Boss, I just found out that this is going to cost an extra $2,000.
Yeah. And I want you to know I can help a little bit with that, but I can't do everything. And yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good.
Okay. And
what about research?
Okay, so big companies tend to, where they make moves frequently between two cities. So we talked about Coca-Cola moving people between Atlanta and Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And so people go backwards and forwards between those two cities fairly regularly. So Coke probably has a table that says, this is the cost of a 3-bedroom house, this is the cost of a 4-bedroom house, whatever.
In Cincinnati, in Atlanta,
exactly. Yep. So they know roughly what they're going to end up paying for the person who moves whichever way they move. But if the day that you move or the month that you move, there are no houses available in the size that you need for your family in the price bracket that they have on their table, you are a little stuck.
There is an economy between houses in Cincinnati and houses in Atlanta in the macro sense. But in the micro sense, it may be constrained in some fashion. And you're not, as David Ogilvy once said, consumers are statistics, but customers are people. And no one, there's no family living near Wichita, Kansas with 2.3 kids. And no one has an average job search. Everyone has their own a job search, which adds up to be the aggregate that this gigantic bell curve. Same thing with moves, right?
Exactly.
Everybody's different. Every move, every location, every house, the amount of your house is worth, how much equity you have, where you're moving, where the office is. Think about Atlanta. There's 20 different areas in Atlanta. I mean, the difference between Snellville and Social Circle and Marietta and Buckhead and the Varsity, where Georgia Tech is, night and day, every single one of them. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, good.
So, of course, thanks to Google and the beauty of the internet, you can do your research about pretty much anything ahead of time. And even if you're going abroad, we checked, I still can't say this, Riyadh,
yeah,
Saudi Arabia.
Very well done.
In Saudi Arabia.
A lovely town, by the way, yeah.
Just to see if we could find rental homes there, and there are a bunch of sites in English with the rental prices for places in Riyadh, because...
And 25 years ago, to be clear, there was no internet, and so all of this knowledge existed in the relocation experts.
Exactly.
And they were incredibly important. They're less important now, thanks to the internet. But they're incredibly important if you don't take advantage of doing Google searches or Bing searches or Yahoo searches or Ask.com searches for Riyadh rental apartment.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because there's a huge expat community in Saudi, and in a lot of the places abroad that you may be sent to, there are big expat communities.
Percentage of places typically that US, UK, or let's say English-speaking Europeans would be expatted to, percentage that has some English-speaking expatriate community on the web that you can get in touch with.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, I was going to say 95. Yeah, it's just not even.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could get posted to somewhere really weird, like Irkutsk, but other than that, yeah.
Yeah, you'd be surprised how much you know, there are real estate agents, rental agents in all of the countries where all of the cities where there's a lot of expats who just deal with expats. And there are also forums on the web that I found really helpful when I was moving over here, where people are prepared to answer your questions about visas, about houses, about which areas to live in, all sorts of questions. So there's a there's always a community to reach into. So the two things that we recommend that you absolutely do your research on, there's a bunch of other stuff, but two things that are important are the cost of living, which we also talked about,
and the cost of housing.
And the cost of housing, exactly.
Let's talk about cost of living first.
Okay, so as with all research, you can Google cost of living index and you'll come up with several different sources, and it's better to search several. It's better to take the number of 3, 4, 5 and average them.
Sure, okay.
Than to take one number. You probably can't tell which one's the most accurate. So take an average. It's probably roughly right. And the other thing that's important when you're doing research is to look at when the data was gathered. So especially if HR has a table and their table is from 2010, and you can find something on the internet that's from late 2011, your data is more accurate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes you might be able to get more.
Yeah, help somebody understand. How does the cost of living index appear to them? What number do they get? How do they understand the relative cost of San Antonio versus New York City?
Okay, so the cost of living people take a basket of goods, like milk and orange juice and bread and gas and electricity, and they add those up, and there's an average. You know, there's a point in the middle of the bell curve, which is 100, and then every place is compared to that 100. So they might be 110, or they might be 88, or wherever, one side or the other.
So in other words, if I'm moving from San Antonio to New York City, San Antonio, and folks, for those of you who don't know, I live near San Antonio some of the time, and San Antonio might actually be like an 87 compared to an average for the major metropolitan statistical areas in the US of 100. And if I'm moving to Manhattan, I think Manhattan's like 150. So it's literally, if my firm said, we want you to move to New York, we're going to open an office. And of course, we're not made of money, Mark. Mm-hmm. And so we're offering you 80 now so we can pay you 85 to go to New York City.
You've just taken a 30 grand pay cut, yeah.
I'm getting the same amount of cash, but my ability to maintain something within one standard deviation of my standard of living is zero. It can't happen. Yeah.
Exactly. Which is why cost of living research is important.
Exactly. Good. Okay.
Okay, and then cost of housing. So again, you need to know the amount that you're going to be getting from your company in terms of rental payments, if they're going to pay them, and what that buys you in wherever you're going to move
to. Right.
Or you want to think about if your house sells for the amount that you expect it to, what kind of house you're going to be able to buy in the place that you're going to, and whether or not your spouse and your family will have enough space.
Right. I just had a discussion. I can't remember where it was. And I said to someone, you know, the market is such that a lot of people's houses are underwater. Oh, I know what I was saying. I was saying that managers are responsible for results and retention, but retention rates lately are not an accurate indicator of how good a manager is, because nobody's moving jobs, in part because in the US anyway, their mortgages are underwater. It's not unheard of that someone say to a company, I would love to go to Shanghai. It's really on my list of the top three places I want to go in the world, Shanghai, Berlin, and London. I'm making those up. And you're willing to help me with my house, but you won't pay off my mortgage. And if I leave and sell my $500,000 house for the $300,000 I get right now, I have $200,000 in debt. I won't be able to buy a house in Shanghai or wherever, or Berlin or whatever, and I'll have a debt like that for the rest of my life. You wouldn't say it that way to the company, but that's the kind of thing you would have a conversation about. Exactly?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've got to know the data, and you've got to have your data, not the data that they're willing, that they have to provide for you, because who knows whether that's supportive of your argument or not.
Right. Okay.
Or accurate for you. And then buried in this paragraph is the very important question. Would you turn down an opportunity to move across the country for the great job, the job you've always wanted, for a $10,000 deficit?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, there are a lot of people who won't. they do the cash analysis and they say, I won't do it. And I think back to getting out of the Army years ago, and Procter & Gamble offered me 26.6, which was less. And folks, just to be clear, that was 30 years ago, okay? They offered me 26.6 without bonus, without commission. And Nalco Chemical, whose people were so wonderful to me and it broke my heart to say no to them, offered me 39.9. And it just seems mathematically bizarre that 26.6 is exactly two-thirds of 39.9 with bonus and commission on top of it. And I took Procter & Gamble simply because I was willing to take a $10,000 pay cut, because as a captain in the Army, I was making probably 35, and I was willing to take a $10,000 pay cut because it was Procter & Gamble. Mm-hmm. By the same token, if Procter & Gamble had asked me to move and they said, we can't give you a cost of living increase, but you will be the leader of this state, and we believe this state is going to grow by 30%, I'd say, roger that, okay, I'll do it. Not saying everybody has to, but you need to have your facts in order. You need to be able to marshal what facts exist and what opinions you have and put those two things together. But you can't put opinion facts together if you don't have the accurate facts to begin with.
Yeah. Okay. And the thing I always tell people about $10,000 deficits is by the time you divide it by 12 and taken out the tax, it's next to nothing.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like you're living high off the hog. It doesn't feel like $10,000 a year if you did break it down to 24 biweekly payments or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So, having covered the research you need to do, we're going to talk about spouses and working.
Okay.
So, people tend to think about spouses not working, particularly in expat moves. So, often the visa, as we said, often the visa will specifically say that a spouse cannot work.
It's fascinating. People don't understand that. And you think, well, we're free, and you know, I'm going to a free country. But the issue is protecting the home talent market.
Exactly.
And so we're allowing a visa to come in for one, but we don't want somebody else to take away a job from a local person, so they restrict it. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, good.
And it's not always true. In some places, the spouses are allowed to work. In some places, they're allowed to study.
Right.
So knowing what they're going to be allowed to do is an important sort of first step in the whole spouse discussion.
Right, but even if there's no visa, if you're going from San Francisco to Brownsville, Texas, the question of will your spouse work as a function of or related to whether your spouse can work,
yeah,
if she's a venture capitalist in San Francisco, there's no jobs for venture capitalists in Brownsville. That affects things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. If the employment market isn't there for your spouse, even in the US, you still can't work. He still can't work.
Yeah.
Okay. And this question, so the question of spouses is not just about your financial situation, although
right,
with dual income households being common, it is. You know, even if you're getting a cost of living, if your cost of living is going to stay the same, if your spouse is going to lose their income, your family is going to have less money.
Right.
And even if that's your fund money for your family, if it's a 2 year secondment, are you going to live without fund money for two
yeah.
years? And maybe that's not what your family wants to do.
I would think it's actually fund money simplifies it beyond the better example, which is, I can make $10,000 more, and this is really a leap in my career. But for the next 2 years, while I'm really investing in my career, my spouse cannot work, and she loves her job, and she will not be able to work, and I'll be able to really take a step forward. We have a saying in Texas, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. And the idea that, oh, well, we'll just double down on my career, when in fact your spouse and you have been somewhat co-equal, is bizarre. There is no amount of money that can make up for a spouse who feels that the move was lopsided relative to the other spouse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Miserable. Sure. It's no fun. So that decision of whether or not you're going to move and your spouse's working conditions once you've moved, it is very complex and something that you probably want to consider really carefully.
And the point is, the relocation package, regardless of what the economics of that is, if you're not considering, the reason we have this unusual pairing of does your spouse work or not with the economic realities of what a relocation package is because you cannot have a good move without understanding how each of those factors plays in and how they interact with one another.
Exactly.
And doing well in one and poorly in the other, you're probably gonna have a bad move, and it may turn into a bad experience overall, which is not something most people's careers can't do. You can't do well if, in fact, home life or the move itself is a drag on your personal experience.
Exactly.
Yeah, good. So, wrap us up.
Okay, so the first thing we said, talked about was knowing what your company policy is and having a clear idea of what they are and are not going to offer you.
And if your boss says we're going to move, it's
completely...
Say yes first and then say, and boss, can you tell me what the policy is?
Absolutely.
And then the boss would say, I don't know, say, well, who should I call? Call HR. And that's the next phone call, right?
Exactly.
Maybe after the spouse, right?
Yeah,
okay, good.
Exactly.
Good.
Do your own research. Don't rely on what the company is going to provide for
yep.
you. And think about the things that are important to your family,
yeah.
not necessary. You know,
yeah, that's just being an educated consumer and being a good member of a family unit. Really, what it boils down
exactly.
to. Exactly. Yeah. Good.
Okay. And the question of will your spouse work, will your spouse be able to work, and does he or she want to,
yeah.
is really important in the overall decision-making
yeah.
process. It's just not about the money and Paris.
Yeah. It's not about the money and Paris. Don't be penny wise and pound foolish, and the pound is always on the side of your spouse, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, good.
Okay.
Okay. Folks, you heard it first here tonight. That was Wendy Lord and myself, whom we've heard before on Career Tools. We hope to hear her voice many times in the future. Well done, Wendy. Welcome aboard.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone. That's it. We'll see you next week. So long.